NATO. But if you even mention something like that in Western discourse, you're just told you're a Russian propagandist. And that's how there's been a huge breakdown of any kind of rational, serious debate in the West, when you can't even have a basic, simple conversation of understanding global politics because you're just called a Russian propaganda. And I do worry, actually, whether it may well have a detrimental effect on Western policy making. Because if you're a politician or an expert, Oxford or Cambridge or LSE, whatever, or
LSE is better. Okay.
But if you're a serious guy, or just as importantly, if you're a protester on the street, if you mention maybe NATO has had a bit of a part of it, you can't even say that, or you're just told you're a Russian propagandist. So I worry whether that will actually have a detrimental effect on Western policymaking. If at some point they think, or some politicians want to say, maybe this isn't good for Europe, maybe these sanctions are hurting us more than them, maybe we should start promoting peace. Well, that's Russian propaganda even as well, if you just promote negotiations. So my worry is that there's a breakdown in European policymaking as well, that nobody can even have a rational debate about this war anymore out of being fear of just being called a Russian propagandist.
I think, Johnny, we're already there in a certain extent. I think it's even beyond the policymaking. We have now basically these people that are now the leaders in the West are of such low quality. I mean, historically speaking, you know, they're just careerists. I mean, if you look at now what's going on with the Tory party in Britain, I mean, every 6 months, every couple of years, you have one of these clowns, you know, becoming the new head, and nobody's voted for them. And,
you see Henry Kissinger.
Exactly. I was going to mention that. Exactly. I mean, is he a Russian propagandist when he talks about, you know, the Russia's interests have to be taken into account? Is he a Russian propagandist too now?
Well, I think he's an associate member of the kill list that I'm on, actually, as well. but when even he is saying that, I think he was promoting negotiations or promoting the idea of Ukraine thinking about ceding some territory. You look at these politicians in the past. I think what Margaret Thatcher, I was no fan of Margaret Thatcher, but she was a very clever woman and a patriot and a grand strategist, if you will.
Right.
I wonder what these politicians of the past would have done in this conflict. Would they have pushed NATO into Ukraine and provoked a war with Russia or not? And you're quite right pointing out the bad standard of Western politicians. I mean, Joe Biden is clearly not physically fit to be
if you look at Liz Truss is probably going to become the head of the Tory party. Remember her visit to Russia and not knowing that, I mean, not even having basic information and knowledge about what she's going there to talk about, because they're just careerists. They're not statespeople. They're not there to actually run a country responsibly. They just want to put it on their resume and then go and work in corporate banking afterwards. So,
as a general rule, I'd like my leader of my country to be smarter than I am.
Absolutely. You mentioned Kissinger and the idea of actually, you know, understanding strategy and understanding that a country like Russia has its own interests. Hey, you know, surprise. I want to go back to your countryman, Halford Mackinder, who in the late 19th century, he actually wrote the blueprint of all this, what we're seeing today. He talked about the idea that if Britain wants to rule the world, it has to rule West Asia and Eastern Europe. And one of the things that he proposed is that there has to always be a region of buffer states between Germany and Russia, and that the West, or in his terms at that time, of course, it was the British Empire, has to always weaponize and take advantage of these petty nationalisms. So you have this issue of Poland, you have the issue of Ukraine, you have the Baltic states. So they actually fulfill a function for Western strategists, these countries that are, you know, in the east of Europe, neighboring Germany to the west, to the east, and neighboring Russia to the west. Because Russia always feels that it was threatened from the west, if we look at history, it was always invaded from the west. So when the idea of German unification happened, one of the things that they promised the Soviets at that time was, okay, we're not going to expand NATO into the east and into your area. Of course, completely lies. You know, everything, we now have basically NATO in the Baltic states being only a few kilometers away from St. Petersburg. So what I'm trying to point out is this, that when we see these extremists, as you pointed out, these neo-Nazis, these people who are, you know, threatening children, the exploitation of this is not simply something that's done by some evil skinhead tattooed guy in Kiev. Yes, that person is there. He's the tip of the spear, so to speak. But this has a long history of being exploited. And as you very correctly point out, I think the important issue here is that this is damaging the West. You know, we have all these... Please, go ahead. This is not simply about, the Ukrainians or the Russians. It's damaging the West as a society.
Yeah, this is my concern. I think the West has made a massive miscalculation here. I think Victoria Nuland, who is the American main person in Ukraine, she was pushing. And she was one of the neocons of American foreign policy. She was the one pushing for this coup in Ukraine in 2014. And presumably for the policies of the nationalist policies after that. So you've got one neocon part of the American foreign policy pushing and provoking in part this war with Russia. And you've got to question whether it's in the rest of the government's or certainly the people's interest, particularly Europe's interest. Germany and France have not been as pro this war as the Americans and the Brits, of course. And I suspect they did not want this war to happen. I mean, take Germany, for example. You're fueling a proxy war against your major gas suppliers. I mean, are you crazy? And now exactly. German people are being told that they're going to have to have... They're having shorter showers, and they're going to have to cut their living standards right throughout the winter. And you wonder whether it's really in, particularly the European people's interest. There's one kind of philosophy I've heard is that United States is trying to damage Europe. There's this old saying of keep Germany down and keep Russia out of Europe.
And keep America in. It's the third part of it is keep America in.
Yeah, absolutely. There's many people in the German conservative establishment. I'm not talking about some crazy left-wingers like myself. I'm not talking about some serious conservative parts of the German establishment who feel they should have good relations with Russia. And that's very much my view, that Europe should have good relations with Russia. There's no reason they shouldn't. Historically, Russia's always wanted to be friends with Europe and get on with Europe. Vladimir Putin's been very keen. He even asked at one point what the possibilities are of Russia joining NATO. But it's I worry that European policy is being fueled or controlled by the American policy. And that's my fear, it's frankly a European patriot, that American foreign policy is detrimental to the European people.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard on Imam Khomeini's struggles against the despotic regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, especially his opposition to the so-called White Revolution, which was a plan to legitimize the Shah rule. This time, we are going to dwell upon the events which led to the Imam's arrest in 1963. As you know, we have tried to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. Stay with us, please. Imam Khomeini's opposition to the ceremonial referendum of the Shah awakened political groups, and they accompanied the Imam in the struggles. But the regime announced that the referendum was successful, and most of the people voted for it. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, at the threshold of the Iranian calendar year 1342, corresponding with March 1963, announced a public mourning. The Imam said, "I announce this feast, Nowruz, as mourning for the Muslim community in order to make Muslims aware of the dangers ahead of the Quran and the country." The Imam had smartly announced that Nowruz as mourning day, not due to the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, but rather for the conspiracy of colonialists against Islam and the Quran. He said in a speech on the last day of Isfand 1342, corresponding with 1963, "This year we have no feast, and I announce this feast as a public mourning, not because of coincidence with the martyrdom of Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, who has a lofty status, but due to the disasters and losses that have been inflicted on Islam. This year was not a happy year for Muslims. In this year, colonialism schemed plots against Islam. The wicked agents of colonialism insulted the Quran. They designed plans to violate the luminous laws of the Quran. They designed schemes and have plots in mind. If Muslims know what plots and designs are underway against the dignity of Islam, the happiness of Muslim nations and independence of Islamic countries, they will never mark feast." The announcement of public mourning by Imam Khomeini moved the entire Iranian nation. On the 2nd of Farvardin, the agents of Shah regime intended to disturb the ceremony held at Imam Khomeini's home on the occasion of Imam Sadiq's martyrdom, but they failed. Then, the security agents of the regime assaulted Faizia school in Qom and massacred many seminary students and mourners of Imam Sadiq to cause fear among the public, particularly ulema. However, Imam Khomeini called on people to be resistant and help the injured. The news of the bloody event soon spread to the whole country, and preachers took stances against the brutal regime. Nearly 2 months later, the atmosphere of the country was zealous and inspired by Imam Hussein's epic as Ashura was approaching. Imam Khomeini called on preachers and ulema to expose the Shah's servility to the U.S. and Israel and the dangers of this puppet regime for Islam and Muslims. Thus, people in Tehran held demonstrations in Tehran on the day of Ashura, and many of them and the near cities went to Qom to hear the Imam's speech. On that day, Imam Khomeini delivered his historical speech in which he directly addressed the Shah. He said, "Oh, Mr. Shah, I advise you to give up these acts. You are being fooled. I don't like to see everyone giving thanks on the day that you are leaving the country. Do not play this much with the nation. Do not be this much opposed to ulema. Take admonition from your father. Listen to the ulema of religion as they like good for you. By God, Israel has no use for you." The speech of Imam Khomeini against the Shah horrified the regime, and on the following day, some of preachers and people attending the speech were arrested. At midnight, the imam's house was assaulted and he was arrested. Imam Khomeini's wife relates, these events continued from the beginning of Muharram till Ashura, leading to that speech. And the next night they came and Ruhollah Khomeini was arrested. The imam had got up for midnight prayer. From the noise, he understood that what was going. It was 2:30 at midnight. The imam came to me and said, they have come to take me. Don't be upset and make no noise. Awaken others and tell them to be calm. He was speaking so calmly that he insinuated calm in me. He was telling these words while I could hear the fast and worried gasps of the dastards behind the door of the house. They seemed to be 300 to 400, but there were more on the main street. There, they changed the imam's car and transferred him from a Volkswagen to a Mercedes. The imam, seeing the street full of agents, told the one beside him, so many people have come to take one? Imam Khomeini's wife continues on the night that the imam was arrested by the agents of the regime. The sound of gasps became faster. The imam left me to put on clothes. I was worried, but I awakened the children calmly, telling them that the strangers wanted to enter the house. Everyone woke up, but no one said anything. Everyone was listening to me. Suddenly, the door of our house was open with a kick, and there was a row. I called on everyone to be quiet and didn't let anybody defy the orders as the imam had asked so. The imam's shout disturbed the calm in the house as he said, what's up? Why are you making so much noise? Our neighbors are asleep. Do not disturb them. At that moment, the door was broken and they poured into the house. They asked the imam's whereabouts, and he pointed to his chest, saying with a sneer, he is here, and said, I am Khomeini. Do not bother anyone. The children wanted to shout, but I prevented them. The commander of the enemy asked, is it you? The imam said, yes, it is me. What do you want at this time of night? Three people said in panic, please let us go. And they took the imam. Mustafa asked the agents to take him too, but the imam told him seriously, go back. Whom are you pleading? After arresting Imam Khomeini, his family was sad, but his wife changed the climate. She says, it was getting clear little by little. Our home, the home whose members had lost their father, source of emulation and leader, was interesting. Everyone was sitting stunned in a corner. Suddenly I said, stand up. It is the time of prayer. And that morning, we performed a nice prayer. Imam Khomeini's wife continues, the imam would relate that on the way, he told them that he wanted to pray, but they didn't let. He told them, stop for a few minutes so that we pray together and then we move. They didn't permit. Upon my insistence, they just stopped and I stooped and touched the soil and performed tayammum. And I was forced to say my prayer in the car. Then, as I caught the sight of oil reserves of Qom, I said, all or many of the miseries of this country stem from oil. They were so much impressed that one of them said, sir, we will return you. We know that we are guilty, but returning is equal to being shot dead. He was not saying these words for flattery, but he was rather speaking sincerely as he wept.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The crisis in Ukraine, which began in February 2022, is arguably the most important event since the fall of the Soviet Union, which has had global ramifications. The crisis has given rise to new alliances and enmities. There have been various attempts and roadmaps to resolve the conflict. Messages have also been exchanged between the involved parties through various means to put an end to the crisis. In the latest such example, it has emerged that Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who visited Russia's capital Moscow earlier this week, was carrying a message from a European leader to Russia over Ukraine. Although the name of the European leader is unknown, some reports say the Western leader in question is the French president Emmanuel Macron.
Indeed, this is the fact that Iran is emerging now as a very important, not just regional player, but global player. And the fact that Iran is getting involved not just in resolving its own problems with the United States and Israel, but in resolving global issues such as the NATO push to the east is an important new step for Iran on the world stage. Indeed, this is a historic moment for Iran.
The details of the peace initiative have also not been revealed, but Amir Abdollahian said he discussed humanitarian issues, the prisoners, and the issue of the Zaporizhia nuclear plant. Since the conflict began in February, Iran has conveyed messages between Moscow and Kiev several times, but this is the first publicized instance of Tehran delivering a message from Europe. Iran has often expressed its readiness to act as an honest broker in any talks aimed at bringing an end to the conflict. And now the mediation role of Tehran between Moscow, Kiev, and the West testifies to the growing importance of Iran at the international stage.
The word on the street, as they say, is that the party trying to help bring peace in this conflict is France. And the reason why France is doing this is an attempt on the local part of France to become a more important power within Europe. It has been more than 20 years since France has done anything independently in Europe without the go-ahead from Germany. And what this signifies is that France is attempting, at least the current administration in the French government, is attempting to separate itself somewhat from Germany, which has been the leader of the EU.
The conflict between Russia and Ukraine has exposed deep problems within the EU. It has further highlighted the United States' influence over the bloc and the military alliance NATO. It's been reported that Russia and Ukraine were close to reaching a deal to end the war, which would have made Ukraine vow that it would never seek NATO membership. But the efforts were scuttled due to the Western pressure, most notably from the UK and the US. UK's outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson is said to have dictated to Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Kiev was ready to sign a deal with Russia, Ukraine's Western benefactors were not. Now, nearly 7 months into the war, European countries are beginning to feel the economic costs of their ambitions for the eastward expansion of NATO. The UK is now experiencing its worst inflation in years and is on the brink of a recession. Economists predict that inflation is likely to top 20% next year. EU countries are not doing better either, with annual inflation of 9.1% for August. Experts have warned of a winter of discontent and a catastrophic economic fallout if the crisis lingers on. It now appears that some NATO members led by the United States are ready to keep the war going on in Ukraine at Ukraine's cost for their own benefits.
American intervention in Latin America began in 1823 when President James Monroe declared the continent to be a U.S. sphere of influence. Under the Monroe Doctrine, Washington claimed the right to intervene militarily across Latin America. That led to the Banana Wars, in which the U.S. military fought to reassert American power and monopoly of plantations in Central America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. Washington has so far orchestrated and supported many coups across Latin America that have been characterized as U.S. foreign policy in the region since the early 20th century. Throughout history, there's been a lot of U.S. meddling in Latin America, especially in Central America. U.S. foreign policy towards Central America heightened during the Cold War and the spread of the leftist movements and revolutions. Many believe that the success of the Cuban Revolution in the 1950s made the U.S. nervous to think that there could be political superpowers like the USSR at the time, leading them in getting involved in what they perceived as their backyard. All this set the stage for a sustained and violent U.S. intervention across Central America, backing vicious local allies in wars that claimed thousands of lives and displaced millions. The latest U.S. attempts of intervening in Latin America in its long list of interventions is considered as what it calls funding for democracy promotion in Cuba. Havana has, however, slammed the move, saying it's illegal and aimed at toppling the government. Let's not forget the USAID program in Cuba. As it was reported at the time, the U.S. secretly created Cuban Twitter to stir unrest and undermine the government of President at the time, Fidel Castro. It started a social network built on texts in hope that it could be used to organize smart mobs to trigger a Cuban spring. The island nation, which is currently facing its worst economic crisis in decades amid U.S. sanctions, announced electricity blackouts this month. Along with soaring food, fuel, and medicine prices as shortage grips, people are observing long queues for necessities. The U.S. trade embargo, which has been in place against Cuba since 1962, was reinforced under former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Trump's successor has also chosen to follow the same path. U.S. intervention has gone far enough that some Congress lawmakers have even advocated for bombing strikes.
We can go back to 1960, in fact, and the Mallory Rubottom memo, it's a State Department memo, that lays out the scenario that Cuba is experiencing today. It says that as secretly as the wording is actually as inconspicuously as possible to disrupt the livelihoods, the employment, the income of the Cuban people. So this has been a policy ever, you know, since 1960, April 6, 1960. The other part of that is that they intend to press the people into rebellion against the government. So clearly, regime change is part of the program.
Venezuela plunged into political turmoil after the U.S.-sponsored opposition figure Juan Guaido launched a botched coup to oust democratically elected President Nicolas Maduro. The attempted coup, which came with the green light off and support of Washington, is yet another example of Washington's intentions with Latin America. The U.S. has even imposed several rounds of sanctions against Venezuela aimed at ousting Maduro and replacing him with Guaido. The sanctions, which include the illegal confiscation of Venezuelan assets abroad and an economic blockade, have caused poverty, a lack of access to basic goods, gasoline shortages, and power cuts. But despite all this, the U.S. seems to have failed in its foreign policy regarding not only Venezuela, but Latin America as a whole, where most of the recently elected presidents have already expressed their ambitions of distancing themselves from the U.S. and establishing stronger ties among themselves.
And, you know, you're not asking this, but there is a new international realignment, and partly I think it's because of these blockades, because of the unilateral action by the United States against countries that are developing to impose its own financial rule on other countries. The United States needs to learn that other countries have a right to determine their own form of government, that their own way of living, that the people in those countries have that right without the United States putting them into debt, without sanctioning them, without creating hardships, and without military attack.
The latest turn of events is also an indication of the U.S.'s failed sanctions policy. Venezuela has, despite the sanctions, managed to double its oil production recently thanks to Iran's help. Iran itself, which is also heavily sanctioned by Washington, is also a prime example of the U.S.'s failed policies, as it has managed to withstand the economic pressure while gradually finding ways around them.
The G7 countries have agreed to implement a price cap on Russian imports, despite warnings from the Kremlin to halt sales to countries imposing the restriction. Finance ministers of the United States, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the United Kingdom agreed on a plan to ban the provisions of services that enable maritime transportation of Russian-origin crude oil and petroleum products globally. This means importers seeking shipping services and insurance cover from companies based in G7 and EU countries would need to adhere to a price cap to transport Russian oil. The level of the cap is still being discussed. The German finance minister has stated the purpose of the move as such.
We want to limit Russia's revenues and at the same time reduce economic damage to our societies. This price cap on Russian oil exports is designed to reduce Putin's revenues.
The cap is expected to take effect at the same time as the next EU embargoes on Russian oil in early December. Moscow has warned that it will retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement the restriction. The Kremlin has warned that a price ceiling will significantly destabilize the oil markets, resulting in scarcity in global oil markets and soaring prices for European consumers. The ban is part of a range of measures taken by the West targeting Russia for the war in Ukraine. In response to the war, the U.S. decided to prohibit the import of oil, refined petroleum products, natural gas, and coal from Russia. These restrictions on Russian energy imports have contributed to higher gas prices and increased inflation pressure across the U.S. Washington's European allies are in no better condition. The European countries have plunged into a devastating energy crisis. Consumers are facing huge bills and the highest rates of inflation since the 1980s. Shell's chief executive officer has earlier warned that gas shortages could persist for several years, raising the prospect of continued energy rationing. Russian energy giant Gazprom has halted flows via the crucial Nord Stream 1 pipeline to Europe. The company cited an oil leak and didn't give a timeline of when the shipments might resume. This comes in the wake of the G7 countries' decision to impose a price cap on Russian oil. The continued shutdown of the pipeline could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, as it is the biggest pipeline for gas from Russia, accounting for about 35% of Europe's total Russian gas imports last year. Russia had already threatened to retaliate by banning oil exports to countries that implement a price cap. Since June, Gazprom has slashed flows through Nord Stream 1 to just 20% of its capacity, citing maintenance issues as a dispute over a missing turbine caught up in Western export sanctions. It has also cut off supplies to several unfriendly European countries and energy companies over their refusal to pay for gas in rubles. The West has already sanctioned many Russian energy exports, but Moscow has continued to earn billions of dollars a month by diverting oil to countries such as China and India. China's crude imports from Russia soared to a record level in May, ousting Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier.
The prices that are being paid for Russian oil are far higher than the cost of actually extracting that oil. So what the Russians are taking advantage, in other words, of the situation they're imposing by their boycotts and by the war in Ukraine.
The West is trying to sever the Kremlin's revenues by imposing a ceiling for Russian exports. But Moscow has proved that it can reduce the exporting of its products to Europe and still have mass revenues. Iran's central bank says Tehran and Moscow have officially started doing business in their national currencies, adding both countries are considering de-dollarizing other parts of their economic ties. Tehran and Moscow had long been seeking to create a mechanism to replace the US dollar with their national currencies, rial and ruble, as part of a joint de-dollarization agenda, regardless of the tough economic sanctions in place against the two nations. Iran and Russia have both been subjected to tough economic sanctions by Western countries and are determined to deepen their economic cooperation, adding that there are great capacities for increasing the volume of bilateral trade. Several officials in Tehran and Moscow have repeatedly accused the United States of using the dollar as an instrument to wage economic and political war. China is another economic and political power that has opted to move toward de-dollarization. In fact, Iran, Russia, and China have discussed the de-dollarization of their trade for decades and have considered launching an alternative for the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication global network, or SWIFT. Following the breakout of the Russia-Ukraine conflict early this year, US-led Western governments imposed several rounds of financial sanctions on Moscow, including freezing its foreign exchange reserves. The thought that the US may move to confiscate one's assets in case they refuse to accept what Washington dictates has caused more countries to consider diversifying their reserve assets away from US dollar. Consequently, many countries have turned away from European democracies and Washington. Regardless of who wins the Ukraine war, the United States and its allies will be the strategic losers. Russia will probably build closer relations with China and other countries on the Eurasian continent, including India, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the Persian Gulf Arab countries.
We are seeing a deepening of ties unlike any other time that we've seen before. And ultimately what this means is that the relationship between Russia and China is no longer being governed by the same economic rules that had governed it prior to this year. That is that Russian rubles are being traded, they're no longer doing business in dollars, and ultimately that is hurting the United States, and it's going to change the dollar's hegemony.
In recent years, with the increased weaponization of the dollar and Washington's use of the dollar to sanction the so-called unruly countries in America's eyes, many countries in the world have awakened and begun to experiment trading in their own national currencies. Since the US has been using the dollar and sanctions as a weapon to hurt other economies, its competitors have no obligation to help the US maintain the dollar hegemony. The dollar's decades-long dominance has placed America in a strong position to dictate the terms of global trade and finance for the last 70 years. But this time, Russia wants to do something different, as Moscow is determined to launch a counter-offensive against Western sanctions and the dollar-centric global financial system. Following the unprecedented Western financial and economic sanctions, Moscow asked all unfriendly countries that are imposing sanctions on it to pay for their fuel purchases in Russia's rubles. The measure immediately helped stabilize the value of the ruble and significantly diffuse the negative impact of Western sanctions. In addition to crude oil and natural gas, some economists have suggested Moscow extend the requirement for importers of Russia's grain, chemical fertilizers, and other products to transact in rubles instead of dollars or euros.
I think what we're witnessing now is the birth of a multipolar world order. And what that means ultimately is that after the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s, the United States became the single hegemonic global power. And what we are seeing now is that the United States, after two decades of brutal wars in the Middle East, in North Africa, of the rampant imperialist expansion and regime change policies and nation-building policies of the U.S. regime, that now Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, South Africa, many countries are coming together and saying no more to U.S. Expansionism.
Russia and China certainly are engaged in a bid to change the U.S. rules-based order, but instead of trying to replace one hegemony, that is the dollar, with another, they are encouraging the rest of the world to assert their autonomy and independence.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with Friday prayer leaders from across the country in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on July 27, 2022.
Some of our Friday prayer leaders took part in economic activities in the past. They failed in these activities because they did not know what they were doing. Others took advantage of the situation and they became a burden on the system, and some are still continuing with this. Never get involved in economic matters. The administration of clerical organizations is up to the people. Gentlemen, unfortunately, some are ashamed to say that seminaries are supported by the people. This is nothing to be ashamed of. Rather, it is something to be proud of. What this means is that they do not need the government or those in power to give them money. This is a big advantage. It allows them to easily stand by the people. You see, seminaries have sided with the people and have stayed alongside the people in many different cases. They have been able to easily confront the various governments and those in power. If there were those amongst the clergy who had connections or received funding from a certain place, they were not able to stand by the people and they remained behind. No, we receive funds from the people and there is nothing wrong with that. It is the same with the Friday prayers. People need to help and they do help. When you take part in economic activities, set up businesses and do these sort of things, people say, these people already have money. Not only will they not help you, they will also have expectations from you. So, these were some points about the behavior of a Friday prayer leader.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to say a few things about the sermons now. First of all, it should be noted that the Friday prayer sermons and the Friday prayer leaders are spokesmen for the Islamic Revolution. That's it. No one should expect anything other than this from the Friday prayer leader. He is a spokesman for the Islamic revolution. He explains the foundations of the revolution. He calls for what the revolution calls for, and he belongs to the revolution. It's always been like this. It's been like this throughout history. The Friday prayer leader will have carried out a great duty if he is able to convey religious and revolutionary concepts according to the needs of the present day. There are many concepts of the revolution that we once proclaimed, followed, and are still following to this day. But today, the same concepts should be explained and conveyed with a new language, with words that are suitable for the present age.
In the limelight.
Reading about Europe's energy crisis in newspapers or hearing about it on TV or radio news sections may shock everyone. But in reality, this crisis is worse than what is described in news headlines. With days left to the cold seasons in this continent, spiraling inflation and soaring energy crisis have worried European families. Experts have warned that this crisis may transform into a catastrophe in the upcoming month. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details about this issue. The title of this article is Europe's Energy Crisis May Become Catastrophe in Months Ahead. Stay with us, please. In the eyes of American news publication Foreign Policy, you have no idea how bad Europe's energy crisis is. With this headline, Foreign Policy wrote, "If most of the world is struggling with higher energy prices, Europe is being stretched on the rack, forcing European leaders to improvise bailout plans and emergency measures to spur consumers from damaging economic pain come winter." The biggest problem is spiking natural gas prices, which have been wreaking havoc across the continent, turbocharging inflation, hamstringing industries, and making ordinary people shudder when they get their power bills in the mail. European natural gas prices are now around 10 times higher than they were on average over the last decade and about 10 times pricier than in the United States. Alex Monton, an expert on global gas markets at Rapidan Energy Group, a consultancy, said European natural gas is so expensive it's like paying $500 for a barrel of oil, and these are the good months. Monton said things are at a crisis point, adding, "We have astronomic gas prices, and we're still a few months away from when gas demand really peaks during the winter. There is genuine uncertainty whether there will be sufficient gas to meet demand throughout the winter."
Thank you.
Foreign policy continued. The gas problem is largely due to Russia-Ukraine conflict, which has disrupted exports of Russian gas to Europe and raised prices everywhere else. But it's not just the war. Alternative supplies of gas are expensive. Climate change has drained rivers so much that many of Europe's nuclear plants are offline. And there has been more than a decade of confusion among European policymakers about how to build shock absorbers into the system. Power prices in both Germany and France reached record levels this week again, a reflection of the continent's ever-deepening power emergency. As nations buckle under the economic pressures, desperate times have called for desperate measures. Britain announced a painful 80% spike in the cap for household energy costs, while Germany increased bills by almost 500 euros. Time also on the energy crisis in Europe roads. Until blackouts begin or pump prices make driving actually unaffordable, most people generally think no more often of energy than of air. In many other places, especially Europe, the escalating situation is impossible to ignore, and it's going to get a lot worse. The worst has yet to come. In cold weather, the heating season, consumption draws mainly from fossil fuels, especially natural gas and oil, because most heating systems are still petroleum-fueled. Like every year, demand for natural gas will thus increase dramatically come winter. With Europe dependent on Russian imports for over 40% of its gas needs, and 46% for coal and 27% for oil, Russia has a lot of leverage. Euronews came with a worrying headline saying Europeans' worry cost of living crisis will cause social unrest. Many Europeans worry that high inflation due to the current energy crisis could fuel social unrest, protests, and strikes, according to a new survey in France, Germany, Poland, and the UK, conducted by pollster YouGov for the non-profit organization More in Common. The survey showed that cost of living has become the most important issue for Europeans in the four countries polled. A majority of people surveyed in all four countries said they were worried about social unrest in the coming month. In France, 4 in 10 people said they wanted to see a return of the Yellow Vest protest movement. Europeans are also feeling the impact of energy crisis. 1 in 5 people surveyed said they were drawing down from their savings, while 1 in 10 said they were skipping meals, the survey showed. Many are already struggling to cope, having to draw from savings or skip meals, particularly among disengaged and low-trust segments of the population, according to the report from More in Common entitled Navigating the Cost of Living Crisis. The vast majority believe this won't be a short crisis, with many seeing no end in sight. A majority of those surveyed in Poland and Germany said they were shopping around for better deals on groceries. A majority of those surveyed said they expected to cut down on heating this winter due to high energy prices. The survey also showed that the Europeans in the four said countries had low trust in their government's ability to handle the crisis. It found that while overall people don't trust any political party to handle the crisis, opposition parties, including populists, are making gains. In the UK, trust in the Labour Party was 20 points higher than in the Conservatives. In France, the party most trusted to deal with the crisis was the far-right National Rally. Pessimism seems to be widespread across Europe. Few Europeans expect that the cost of living crisis will end anytime soon, with over one in three people surveyed uncertain that it will ever end. Majorities in the countries polled would like to see an accelerated transition to renewable energies and believe renewables are a way to achieve energy independence faster. The polling was conducted online in late July with a sample of 7,000 adults from the UK, France, Germany, and Poland.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a council of ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace,
Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians have staged a rally in front of the Red Cross.